while Marconi was making headlines by trying himself to intercept messages from nearby planets, Tesla wrote, "I was naturally very much interested in recent reports that these supposed planetary signals were nothing else than interfering undertones of wireless transmitters. These disturbances I observed for the first time from 1906 to 1907 occurred rarely, but subsequently they increased in frequency. Every transmitter emits undertones, and these give by interference long beats, the wavelength being anything from 50 miles to 300 or 400 miles. This statement supports the hypothesis that the 1899 impulses also stem from some competitor. Furthermore, Tesla suggests the actual mechanism for his encounter, an undertone effect. And it appears that he unfortunately also provided, through Marconi's piracy, the very oscillators used to transmit the signals. The transmitter on the high seas in England, therefore, was attuned to the receiving equipment in Colorado. Coincidentally, this realization in 1906-1907 occurred, as we shall see, during a time of great emotional stress. Rather than face the truth, the mystical Serb clung to a supernatural explanation. The most ardent proponent of the outer space scenario was undoubtedly the journalist Julian Hawthorne. The son of Nathaniel Hawthorne, Julian authored a series of elaborate treatises on Tesla's philosophy, laboratory work, experiments in interplanetary communication, and place in history. Perhaps because he had engaged in a spectacular duel of articles with his brother-in-law, George Lathrop, who wrote science fiction tales about Tom Edison battling invaders from Mars in Arthur Brisbane's New York Journal, Hawthorne took up Tesla's extraterrestrial cause. The competition between Edison and Tesla would never abate, and it continued even into the realm of science fiction. Like many creative individuals, Edison had an interest in the occult. With Charles Batchelor, he had studied telepathy, and he had worked with spiritualists on a telephone to communicate with departed souls. Edison was interested in space travel and interplanetary communication. Lathrop, who had married Julian's sister, had worked with Edison since the mid-1890s in co-writing a number of articles that became the precursors to latter-day fantastic tales. In Lathrop's story, Edison's Conquest of Mars, when the Red Planet Warriors invaded the Earth, the Wizard of Menlo Park invented a disintegrating ray, and it was Edison to the rescue of the universe. The son of Nathaniel Hawthorne would not be outdone. And how will Tesla reply to those signals from Mars? Julian Hawthorne. The other day, there happened to Mr. Tesla the most momentous experience that has ever visited a human being of this Earth. Three fairy taps, one after the other, at a fixed interval, traveling with the speed of light, were received by Tesla in Colorado from some Tesla on the planet Mars. No thoughtful man can have much doubt, then, that little as we are aware of it, we must for ages have been subjected to the direct inspection of the men of Mars and of the older planets. They visit us and look us over year after year and report at home, they are not ready yet. But at length, a Tesla is born, and the starry men are on the watch for developments. Possibly, they guide his development. Who can tell? Perhaps more than any other writer, Hawthorne elevated Tesla to the order of an interplanetary Adonis, whose mystical destiny upon the Earth was to give its inhabitants electrical power, instrumentation, and enlightenment. Note the overblown yet elegant description Hawthorne pens in meeting with the sorcerer. Ever and anon, there appears a man who is both scientist and poet, who walks with feet on the ground, but with his head among the stars. Men of this mark are rare. Pythagoras was one. Newton must have had a touch of the inspirational. In our own times, Tesla is the man. He was born in Herzegovina, of Greek stock, one of the oldest families there. I believe he is a prince at home. Hawthorne interviewed Tesla in the same article, in which the inventor reiterated his extraterrestrial hypothesis and his technological vision of the future, creating a world in which cheap energy would be available for all, and humanity could begin to take its rightful place in the evolutionary hierarchy. And although Hawthorne tried to introduce some doubt as to the definite reality of the extraterrestrial encounter, a quarter of the way through the 5,000-word treatise, the writer softened the potential criticism by rationalizing that the hopes Tesla holds out embody things that ought to be true, that would immensely enlarge and beautify the world if they were true. Concluding with a rhetorical question, Hawthorne wrote, "And what about conversing with Mars? Tesla will do what he was sent here to do." Backed by the opposition, factions of the press also lashed out vigorously. One severe critic, under the byline of a mysterious Mr. X, cautioned intelligent readers, "Mr. Tesla obviously wants to figure in the newspapers. Everyone will be greatly interested if it were true that signals are being sent from Mars. Unfortunately, he has not adduced a scrap of evidence to prove it. His speculations on science are so reckless as to lose an interest. His philosophizing is so ignorant as to be worthless." While in Colorado, Tesla negotiated with officials of the U.S. Navy and Lighthouse Board, with 9 letters passing between them from the spring of 1899, and upon his return to New York through the autumn of 1900. On May the 11th, Rear Admiral Francis J. Higginson of the U.S. Navy wrote Tesla a letter which was forwarded to Colorado. "Dear Sir, I would like to ask you if you cannot arrange to establish a system of wireless telegraphy upon the light vessel number 66, Nantucket Shoals, Massachusetts, which lies off about 60 miles south of Nantucket Island." Higginson stated explicitly, "The Lighthouse Board has no money, so funding will have to be paid from some outside source." Tesla sent his humble apologies for a tardy reply because of a severe cold, and then ended the note with this seemingly innocuous line, "It is also my sincere hope that I am not standing in the way of some other expert more deserving and better able to fulfill the task than myself." The statement strikes this investigator as odd. Why would Tesla write that he was potentially standing in the way of some other expert more deserving, when he knew that this was a completely false statement? No other expert was more deserving or more knowledgeable than he. Moreover, he knew that it was very likely that other experts were pirating his work, so why would he encourage more of that activity? This was clearly a self-deprecating and self-destructive element. Be that as it may, the response from Commander Perry, Higginson's associate, was just as peculiar. "Office of the Lighthouse Board, Washington, D.C., 16th of August, 99. Mr. N. Tesla, Experimental Station, Colorado Springs, Colorado. Sir, in acknowledging the receipt of your letter of the 11th of August, 99, from certain expressions used in it, the Board fears there may be some misunderstanding, so in order to prevent you from going to any trouble of expense, the Board desires to say that it has taken no action as yet towards providing any apparatus for using wireless telegraphy, as no appreciation is available for the purpose. When it does take up the question of installing apparatus for communicating with light vessels, your great name and fame in such matters will ensure earnest consideration of yourself. Respectfully yours, T. Perry, Commander, U.S. Navy." Apparently Commander Perry read into Tesla's letter information that wasn't there. The inventor did not discuss reimbursement, but took the opportunity in another letter to chastise Perry for his miserly response, writing on August the 20th, 1899, from his experimental station in Colorado Springs to the Lighthouse Board, Washington, D.C. "Gentlemen, on this occasion, permit me to avail myself of my acquired and precious prerogative as a citizen of the United States, and to express my deep astonishment that in a country of such vast wealth and leading in enlightenment, so important a body as the Lighthouse Board, instead of being provided with unlimited resources, should be trivially hampered and placed in such an awkward position. Very respectfully yours, N. Tesla." Although clever, Tesla's response was short-sighted, as the benefits that would accrue from installing wireless apparatus on this boat would clearly outweigh any short-term loss. The equipment would have been far more advanced than Marconi's. The press and public would see without doubt Tesla's superiority, and other branches of the Navy and armed forces would have created contracts with the inventor. Furthermore, it would have been the first public demonstration by Tesla of long-distance wireless telegraphy. Unfortunately, throughout Tesla's long career, he never demonstrated this capability to anyone other than himself. Nevertheless, Tesla's letter did not destroy his chances with the Lighthouse Board. On September the 14th, Commander Perry responded by offering Tesla the contract because the Navy preferred to award home talent over Marconi. Here was the opportunity of a lifetime. Certainly it was understandable that Tesla needed to stay in Colorado through the autumn. He would return to New York the first week of January 1900. The Colorado experiment was a costly endeavor, and the inventor had now built up momentum, pushing toward the grand conclusion, that is, his wish to send impulses around the globe. Perry wanted action quickly, but asking him to delay 90 days would not have been an unreasonable request. However, from the emotional point of view, Perry had said the wrong thing. He had mentioned the name of Signor Marconi. "Gentlemen, much as I value your advances, I am compelled to say, in justice to myself, that I would never accept a preference on any ground, the merit of my own work excepted, particularly not in this case, as I would be competing against some of those who are following in my path, and as any pecuniary advantage which I might derive by availing myself of the privilege is a matter of the most absolute indifference to me. But since you have reasons for preference, permit me to state that a few years ago I laid down certain novel principles on wireless telegraphy, which I have been since perfecting." Tesla went on to describe the seven features of his system. 1, an oscillator. 2, a ground and elevated circuit. 3, a transmitter. 4, a resonant receiver. 5, a transformer that scientific men have honored me by identifying it with my name, Tesla coil. 6, a powerful conduction coil. And 7, a transformer in the receiving apparatus. Having carefully perused all the reports of the more successful experimenters as they appeared, Tesla discovered that they are all using with religious care these devices and principles without the slightest departure, even in minor details. He ended the letter by offering his services once again, but requesting that the Navy purchase an even dozen transmitters, with the caution that, "In the end, one is apt to be accused of making outrageous prices. It is more than probable that my apparatus will cost more than that offered by others, as I look to every detail myself. With many thanks for your good intentions, I remain very respectfully yours, N. Tesla." The Navy never responded to this letter. 1 year later, on October the 4th, 1900, Tesla wrote Admiral Higginson. 4 days later, the Admiral responded. "It will be necessary, before asking Congress for money to carry on this work, to have further estimates of cost." Tesla's style of writing to the Navy was particularly irritating and filled with contradictions. He claims to be absolutely indifferent to gaining a pecuniary advantage, and yet he tells Commander Perry that the cost might appear to be outrageous. At the dawning stage of a completely new industry, instead of building one or two prototypes to display before the government, Tesla insists on a sizable order. In an early letter, he states that he doesn't want to stand in the way of any competitor. In another, he claims he didn't know there were any other competitors. In one passage, he accuses all his competitors of piracy, which was probably true, and yet in another, he wishes them hearty success. His position was incongruous, to say the least, and it served to scuttle his own cause. This would turn out to be one of the most significant blunders of his career. 27. Thor's Emissary, 1899. The problem was rendered extremely difficult owing to the immense dimensions of the planet. But by gradual and continuous improvements of a generator of electrical oscillations, I finally succeeded in reaching rates of delivery of electrical energy actually surpassing those of lightning discharges. By use of such a generator of stationary waves and receiving apparatus properly placed and adjusted in any other locality, however remote, it is practicable to transmit intelligible signals or to control or actuate at will any one apparatus for many other important and valuable purposes. Nikola Tesla. Tesla went to Colorado in part for reasons of secrecy. His all-important transmitting oscillators and general design had already been pirated, and he would shortly be involved in a variety of priority battles. Looking at the Colorado project from the technical point of view, the inventor was in a virgin field and needed to experiment in order to determine a workable plan for distributing light, information, and power by means of wireless. The measuring of standing waveforms from the electrical storms throughout July confirmed what he had suspected, namely that the Earth had a resonant frequency and could therefore be used as a carrier wave to transmit his signals. Letters between Scherf and Tesla continued on an almost daily basis throughout the summer. In August, Tesla received an invitation to attend the banquet honoring the birthday of the Emperor Francis Joseph. Correspondence also came in from Austria, India, Australia, and Scandinavia. "The last one," Scherf wrote, "is a proposition to become an agent or manufacturer of your new light for Sweden, Norway, and Denmark." To the numerous business inquiries, Tesla wrote, "Tell them that I am on a scientific expedition and will return in a few weeks." There was also correspondence with William Rankin, E.D. Adams, Mr. Coney, a stockholder, and Alfred Brown. Bills were forwarded, and the inventor in turn would periodically mail off funds to cover these expenses. Wages for the crew ran about $90 a pay period. The New York laboratory in turn prepared new equipment to be shipped west, as Scherf continued to send details about their construction. September the 6th, 1899. "Dear Mr. Scherf, can you write about something more interesting than the pump? There are many things happening in a great city. Try and make your correspondence more interesting, such as in sending press clippings. Sincerely, N. Tesla." As was his custom, the inventor lived in the future, writing to Scherf in late August that he expected to return to New York in a few weeks. It would be more like 4 months. At the same time, Lowenstein requested permission to take leave, as he wanted to return to Germany for some family matter. Tesla feared that he might be an industrial spy, but he was only going home to get married. Coleman Cheeto was called on to replace him. "Cheeto has just arrived," Tesla wrote, "and I am glad to see a familiar face again. He looks a little too fat for the work I expect of him." He would come just in time to take part in some of the most spectacular electrical experiments ever performed. A hearty and trustworthy companion, Cheeto would stay at Tesla's call until he was an old man. By that time, he had trained his son Julius to take over. Julius would eventually come to aid Tesla in some of his more clandestine Earth-Lunar experiments, as well as in day-to-day responsibilities. Throughout September, Tesla designed a large number of electronic tubes for his glassblower in New York to fashion and for Scherf to ship, as he continued to document his work with a local photographer. Electrical energy generated exceeded 3 million volts. Tesla reported, "I drew 1-inch sparks between my body and an iron pipe buried in the ground about 100 feet from the laboratory." On the 29th, time-lapse pictures were mailed to John Jacob Astor, sugar refinery king H.D. Havemeyer, his wife and their daughter, Mrs. E.F. Winslow, Stanford White, socialite Mary Mapes Dodge, and the Johnsons. He also shipped copies to Lord Kelvin, Sir William Crookes, Sir James Dewar, William Roentgen, Philip Leonard, and Aldolf Schlabi. "Look them over carefully before delivery," the inventor instructed his liaison, "and do not allow the workers other than yourself and Mr. Ullman to see them." Throughout the autumn, the inventor continued to change the height of the ball at the top of the antenna to measure the change in capacity and relationship to generated wavelengths, in order to tune the equipment to the Earth's frequency and bring the oscillator into resonance with the circuit. Made out of wood, the ball was coated with metal. He also studied the strange phenomena of fireballs, which, when created by natural means, can appear like tumbleweeds of lightning that can roll down a street and smash into a tree or house. They are rarely seen, though they are documented sightings. Although Tesla himself had not witnessed any natural fireballs, he was able to create smaller ones in his lab. Sometimes it appeared as if a ball would form above the coil, but this may have been only an optical effect caused by many streamers passing from various points in different directions. At other times, a big cluster of them would form and spatter irregularly in all directions. He produced them quite by accident, and saw them more than once explode and shatter his tall mast, and also destroy apparatus within his laboratory. The destructive action accompanying the disintegration of a fireball, he declared, takes place with inconceivable violence. In one instance, he pushed the experiments too far, and a fire started. Trapped by streamers that could maim or kill, the inventor had to roll to safety to save his life. To Johnson, he wrote, "I have had wonderful experiences here. Among other things, tamed a wildcat, and am nothing but a mass of bleeding scratches. But in the scratches, Luca, there lies a mind. Mind." A few weeks later, while a photographer was present, Tesla set the roof in flames, but was able to extinguish it before much damage was done. "The display was wonderful in spite of this," he wrote in his diary. Having studied the phenomena, Tesla attributed the generation of fireballs to the interaction of two frequencies, a stray higher frequency wave imposed on the lower frequency-free oscillation of the main circuit. They can also be produced when stray high-frequency charges from random earth currents interacted with charges from his oscillator. The following week, he extended the ball to a height of 142 feet and began propagating waves through the ground. "Referring to electrical or radio wave action at a distance, I know from experience that if proper precautions are not taken, fires of all kinds and explosions can be produced by wireless transmitters. In my experiments in Colorado, when the plant was powerfully excited, the lightning arrestors for 12 miles around were bridged with continuous arcs, much stronger and more persistent than those which ordinarily took place during an electric storm. I have excited loops, coil aerials, and lighted incandescent lamps at a considerable distance from the laboratory without even using more than 5 or 10% of the capacity of the transmitter. When the oscillator was excited to about 4 million volts and an incandescent lamp was held in the hand about 50 or 60 feet from the laboratory," emphasis added, "the filament was often broken by the vibration set up, giving some idea of the magnitude of the electromotive forces generated in the space." Tesla had calculated that the Earth pulsated at varying frequencies, especially 12 cycles per second. With his coils wound with lengths of wire in harmonic relationships to the required wavelengths needed to girdle the globe, he wrote in his diary, "The length of the coil was calculated based on the equation wavelength divided by 4 equals harmonic of total wavelength or required length of coil." Taking into account the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second, and the circumference of the Earth, it was determined that coils would have to be roughly a mile in length, or some harmonic of this figure, to be in a resonant terrestrial frequency. Other components included the thickness of the wire itself and horsepower generated. By increasing the frequency between pulsations, the inventor claimed to be able to boost horsepower to a few hundred thousand, although this amount of produced energy would last only a fraction of a second. Cheeto arrived for work one day in mid-autumn to find the inventor vigorously watering the ground around the metal plate which he had buried near the lab. "If I could only insulate these wires with liquid oxygen, I could reduce losses another magnitude," the inventor said. "Here, put these on." He gave Cheeto a pair of rubber-soled shoes as he laced up a pair for himself. "All the way today, sir?" Cheeto inquired. "To the limit, my friend. Now remember," the inventor cautioned, "keep one hand behind your back at all times." Cheeto responded with a nod of his head. He had no plans to risk electrocution by creating a circuit through his heart. "Throw the switch when you see my signal." "We had better use these, sir." Cheeto handed his boss 2 cotton balls and took 2 for himself, and they plugged them into their ears. The lanky Serb lumbered from his lab in his high shoes, past the mud, to place testing equipment and cold lamps at various locations in the earth, and positioned himself on a knoll about a mile away near Prospect Lake. Even though insulated, sparks jumped from the ground to his feet as he crunched along the path. The sun was low on the horizon as Colorado Springs began to turn on street lamps and electric lamps in preparation for the night. "Now," Tesla waved as Cheeto fired up the equipment. The sound began as a low rumble and built to a roar that was so strong that it could be plainly heard 10 miles away. The ground trembled with the noise as the inventor gazed over to a nearby corral to watch a half-dozen horses rear on their hind legs and gallop frantically away. Butterflies were carried around in circles as in a whirlpool and could not get out no matter how hard they tried. As the flume of streamers stormed up the shaft high above the roof of the lab and blustered out from the apex, splitting lightning bolts fully 135 feet in length. Kaboom, zip, zap, kaboom. Looking to the sky, the wizard held his wireless torches up in triumph as they flickered in his thunder. The end came abruptly. The springs plunged into darkness. He had shorted out the town. Fortunately, the powerhouse had a second standby generator which was started up soon after. Tesla was insistent that he be supplied with current from this reserve machine as soon as it was running, but his demand was refused. Forced by El Paso Electric to fix the damaged generator himself, the inventor was back online in a day or two. In the future, he was told, he would be supplied with current from a dynamo operated independently from the one supplying the El Paso Electric Company's regular customers. By the end of 1899, Tesla was ready to return to New York. He wanted to get home for the holidays to spend them with the Johnsons, but it would take him a little longer to wind things down. In December, he sent for his photographer, Dickinson Alley, to capture his work in the best possible light. By using multiple exposures, Alley would create what is perhaps Tesla's most famous photograph, that of the inventor sitting calmly reading a book, dwarfed by myriad tongues of explosive lightning. This picture is a multiple exposure. Tesla, of course, was not sitting there at the time the oscillator was fired up. The electricity would have killed him. December the 22nd, 1899. Dear Mr. Tesla, we will keep your memory green Christmas Day. How lovely it would be if you should suddenly appear in our midst to spend it with us. I sometimes wonder if you could make me glad again just to see you. It is so long since gladness has been in my days. Everything that once was has disappeared. It is as if one had gone to sleep in soft moonlight and had anchored out of place and out of time to find himself in the Stone Age, himself a stone. What does it all mean? Sometimes I have a little sign of you through Robert by way of the office. I am hoping the new year may bring you what you most desire and that it may bring to us, my dear friend. Faithfully yours, Katherine Johnson. 28. The Hero's Return, 1900. Common people must have rest like machinery, but the great old Nick, the busy one, see him go 150 hours without food or drink. Why, he can invent with his hands tied behind his back. He can do anything. In short, he is superior to all laws of hygiene and human energy. He is a vegetarian that doesn't know how to vegetate. Robert Underwood Johnson. On January the 7th, 1900, Tesla left Colorado Springs with every intention of returning. Engaging C.J. Duffner and another watchman to look after the laboratory, the inventor departed with inexplicit promises for future payment. His funds exhausted, he also left without covering outstanding bills he had incurred with the local power company. The Johnsons were thrilled with the wizard's return, and they celebrated in grand style by dining out. With Gilda's approval, Robert suggested that Tesla compose a discourse on his recent endeavors. Coincidentally, Marconi was in Manhattan, seeking investors and planning on lecturing on his progress in wireless. "When I sent electrical waves from my laboratory in Colorado around the world," Tesla reported, "Mr. Marconi was experimenting with my apparatus unsuccessfully at sea. Afterward, Mr. Marconi came to America to lecture on this subject, stating that it was he who sent those signals round the globe. I went to hear him, and when he learned that I was present, he became sick, postponed the lecture, and up to the present time has not delivered it. Although fearful of Tesla, Marconi was also desirous of obtaining a greater